The world had never witnessed a rise to power quite the way it happened in 1789. A general and his army fought his way to power against a monarchy, but then the general had to be persuaded to vie for a new office called president. Everything George Washington did set a precedent for being president, including refusing to become president for life. Forrest MacDonald is a George Washington expert and historian. He joins us from the studios of Station WUAL in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Mr. MacDonald, thanks very much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Of course, this was not a close election back in 1789, was it?
Not exactly. As a matter of fact, they were willing to create the office of president only because they knew Washington would be the first one. The electors were chosen, and they met in December as the Constitution specified, and the vote was unanimous. And everybody knew it was unanimous. Everybody knew what the vote was. It was in the papers. Washington knew it. Well, now, the first Congress was to be convened on March the 4th of 1789, and the president was scheduled to be inaugurated on that day. But March the 4th came, and there was no quorum in Congress. And the 5th came, and the 10th, and the 15th, and the whole month went by, and there was no quorum. Finally, at the end of the month, toward the end of the month, a quorum was reached. And early in April, the congressmen sat down, and they counted the votes, and there, sure enough, George Washington was the unanimous choice. And on April the 30th, he took the oath of office.
The inauguration, was it certainly spare by today's standards, but he undertook some pains to avoid making it look like a coronation?
The way it unfolded was, the Congress was meeting in the old Federal Hall, which is in New York City on Wall Street, down the street from the New York Stock Exchange. And a committee of the Congress went over to where he was staying and escorted him back. And he came into the room and he sat down in the Senate chamber. And then they all walked outside onto a kind of a gallery there so that as many people as possible could see him take the office. It was administered by the Chancellor of the State of New York outside. And they all walked back inside, and then he delivered his inaugural address.
And that inaugural address, who was he speaking to? What notes was he seeking to strike?
Well, I'll tell you what it was like. It prints out currently at 3 pages. I read it yesterday aloud to time it, and it took me 7.5 minutes. The first paragraph is, golly, all shucks, thanks a lot. I didn't want to do this job, but I'll do my best, that sort of thing. The second paragraph is divine interpretation of, or a biblical interpretation of the American founding, that God saw us through this and God is guiding this experiment and so on. The next paragraph is likewise religious, and it urges, as his farewell address does, the need for religion and morality in public life. That paragraph closes with a fascinating and seemingly a bit presumptuous, but actually, in fact, quite true statement. He said that the sacred fire of liberty and the destiny of the Republican model of government are deeply and perhaps finally staked upon the experiment entrusted to the hands of the American people. Now, you know, for a little pipsqueak country out in the middle of nowhere to be making a claim like that, and yet it was prophetic. Anyway, then the last paragraph is very interesting. It was addressed to the House of Representatives saying, look, I don't take money for public service. Don't pay me. Well, they paid no attention to that, of course, because they pointed out to him later that it says right in the Constitution that he shall be paid, and so that was that.
The second inaugural address. this was historically the shortest, isn't it?
It's about 8 lines. It's a very short thing. All he does is says, thanks, I don't deserve it, I'll do my best.
To what degree did that first inauguration get created in the image that George Washington himself had created? Because we've read over the years that he was not just a plain-spoken general, that on the contrary, he had an idea of how he should look and what his public deportment should be like that drew people to him.
He was very, very much concerned with that, and he understood that executive authority is inherently dual in nature. Mm-hmm. There's the running things side of the presidency, and there's the public image and the ritual monarchy side of the presidency. And he was very careful to make sure that it was not too aristocratical, too monarchical on the one hand, and not too chummy with the people, which would detract from the dignity of the office on the other.
Of course, it's often been remarked over the years that The single action George Washington took that most defined the presidency and, in a sense, ennobled American democracy was not running for re-election for what would have been the third term, which he could have done under the Constitution then, that in a sense, forced this fledgling nation to really become a democracy.
Well, it nudged it very strongly in that direction, but it was not as much a noble thing as it might appear. Washington wanted to leave after his first term, and he actually asked James Madison to write him a farewell address, which Madison did. But then the French Revolution broke out, Citizen Genet arrived, we became embroiled in European affairs and so on. So he was prevailed upon, you know, he sort of had to stay. By 1796, things had calmed down considerably, and he stepped down very, very happy to be down. That set the precedent, but it didn't really establish a tradition yet. The next president, John Adams, of course, only served one term and was not reelected. Then Jefferson came in, and Jefferson served his 8 years. But by the time Jefferson was through, he too was sick to death of it. He wanted to go home. He was a planter. Mm-hmm. He loved being at Monticello, just as Washington loved being at Mount Vernon. And by that time, it was a hoary tradition.
When we watch George W. Bush of Texas take the oath of office, will anything be the same as it was as when George Washington took the oath 212 years ago?
Well, the order of events essentially will be the same. He'll be sworn in, then he'll give the address. You know, if you want to look at models for inaugurations and for inaugural addresses, the super-duper best one of all time was Thomas Jefferson. And Jefferson would be very much appropriate right now, given all the rancor of national politics, because the Federalists and the Republicans had been at each other's throats. The scurrility of public discourse was just unbelievable. I mean, it makes Teddy Kennedy look like a tame man. And Jefferson very quietly said, "We have called by different names brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists." It really is a magnificent example or a statement of the principles on which this country was founded. And, well, there's really not much that a present president can do to recapture that kind of spirit or the spirit of the Washington inauguration.
Professor, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Enjoyed it.
Forrest McDonald teaches history at the University of Alabama, speaking from the studios of WUAL in Tuscaloosa.